This is a conversation with Don Edwards. We are at his home at 3408 Milam Lane in Lexington, Kentucky. It is February 19th, 2002. My name is Ethel White. Could we start with a little biographical information, starting with birth, education, and whatever experiences might devolve on this oral history we're doing?
Okay. My name is Don Edwards. I was born August 25th, 1940 in Corbin, Kentucky. I studied English and philosophy in college, and I went into journalism in 1964. I took a job as a, as a reporter with the Winchester Sun newspaper.
Where did you go to college?
At Eastern. And my sister was a guidance counselor, my brother-in-law was a school superintendent, and my family really, I think, wanted me to be a teacher. But I had the writing bug early on, and I wanted to write, and a newspaper looked like an easy way to get into writing.
Before we move into your journalism career, since we're talking about civil rights, I think when we talked over the phone, you said you had had certain, I don't know what you call them, civil rights experiences, or perhaps something to do with the question of race.
Yes.
As you were, what, growing up or in college? Or
Well, that's correct. It's actually beginning when I was a child. I don't know if you know anything about the history of Corbin, Kentucky or not. It's a small town in southeastern Kentucky. It's not a very old town. I think it actually was just a wide spot in the road until about the 1880s when it grew up along the railroad, the Illinois Railroad. And there had been a terrible labor dispute in Corbin. I think it had probably happened in the 19-teens or maybe around 1920. At that point, I think there had been a strike. The railroad had brought in substitute workers to take the jobs of the people who were on strike, and a lot of those people that they'd brought in were black. And there was what amounted to a combination race riot, labor riot at that time. And nearly all the black people in Corbin were shipped out of town on boxcars. There were only a handful of black people left in the town by the time I was born in 1940. There were some people on my paper route. I think there was a black porter who worked at the hotel. But virtually, it was like a 99.99% white town. My earliest memories of racial matters in that town were things like my father, who was a railroad engineer, had begun on the railroad working with men who were still old enough to remember the assassination of Goebel, which it was generally believed that the Illinois Railroad had paid for. And they told him, and he told me about how all the railroad workers were ordered to vote against Goebel, that their jobs were on the line, that they were told that Goebel would integrate the railroads, and that white people would stop using the railroads, and that they would all lose their jobs if they didn't vote against Goebel. Typical scare tactic. Of course, I think they all voted for him. This is a town that's approximately halfway between Lexington and Knoxville, Tennessee. And black people were actually terrified to go through that town because of its past, because of what had happened there before. And so I remember when I was a child, there was an attempt made to start what was called a colored tourist home in Corbin, a place for black people to stay on the trip, all the roads were two lane back then, and it was a tough trip. The first night that tourist home opened for black people, it was dynamited. And after that, it did not open again. It was the kind of town where in the 1940s, 1950s, US 25 was the main highway. There was no interstate, and US 25 went right down Main Street. And there were instances of black people who would be passing through the town on their way to somewhere else would be stopped at a stoplight and dragged out of their cars and beaten by people who were just loafers who were standing on the corner with nothing to do. It's like a hobby with them.
Do you remember any of that?
Oh, yes, I remember that very well.
Did you ever see it or hear talk
about
yes, it?
Yes, I
what?
Did see it. It was a very racist environment.
What did you see? Can you describe it? Can you remember?
Oh, yes, I can remember that. Just the same way I can remember the railroad strikes and the violence around the railroad strikes. These would usually be guys who had played on the football team. And sometimes they would be out of school, like a year or two older than the graduation age, and they would just be standing around on the corner, and I was downtown. And they would be standing on the corner, and suddenly you'd hear these terrible screams. And they'd started jeering or some sort of conversation with black people who were caught at a red light. And then ran over and just ripped the doors open and pulled them out and started beating them. I witnessed things like that. I didn't actually go to school with black people until I was a senior in high school. That was in 1957. And that was in Richmond, Kentucky, at a school that no longer exists. It was called Madison Model, or Madison High School, but Model was the Eastern Kentucky University Training School, and the two schools were separate, but they combined for athletics because Model wasn't large enough to have an athletic team of its own.
Now, did you say, is this the black school and the white school that combined?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, the public school was Madison, and the private school was Model.
Oh, okay, sorry.
And Model was a training school for practice teaching at Eastern Kentucky. At that time, Eastern Kentucky University was called Eastern Kentucky State Teachers College. And they had a laboratory school on campus, and that was Model.
Okay. But then how, well, let me back up for a minute. When did you actually move to Richmond that year when you were a senior, had you moved before?
Well, here's what happened. I lived in Corbin through the fourth grade. We moved to Richmond so my sister could go to school there, and I lived there fifth and sixth grades. Then in the seventh grade, I went to Valley High in Jefferson County. My father had bought a house at West Point, down there between Louisville and Fort Knox. But my mother didn't like it there, and we stayed there for a year. And then for some reason, my father moved back to Corbin for three more years. So I had the eighth grade in Corbin and the first 3 years of high school. And then in 57, we moved back to Richmond.
So you went to the school that combined for athletics, but what had happened that you were actually going to school with blacks? What had happened in Richmond?
I think what had happened all over the country was the Supreme Court decision that integrated the schools. There were no blacks to go to school with in Corbin, so I never went to school with blacks in Corbin. By the time I was a senior in high school, though, in 1957, the schools had been integrated, and I went to school with black students in 57. This was really kind of surprising in a way, because even though there were black athletes and black students in the public high schools then, the University of Kentucky athletic programs were all white. It wasn't until years later, until the late 60s, early 70s, that they actually integrated. And I remember thinking how tough it was for really good athletes, because we had a couple in our high school who probably could have played college ball, but they were automatically ruled out from ever playing for the state university at Lexington, because at that time it was all white.
Now, you said you remember thinking that. So what was your thinking about? How was your thinking developing, or how had it always been, or what were your reactions to all of this as a teenager?
As a teenager, I thought it was terribly unfair that they should not have a chance to play for the state university when they were such outstanding athletes in high school.
How do you suppose, coming from Corbin, Kentucky, which you just described, why do you suppose you felt the way you did?
Well, I think growing up in Corbin, even though it was a racist environment, it was not like growing up in the Klan or something like that. I don't mean to leave that sort of impression. In fact, children in Corbin, the kids that I went to school with and grew up with, really had more curiosity about black people than they had antipathy toward black people. And so it was when I finally began going to school with black kids in 57, for me it was just more a matter of trying to understand what I'd been missing all of those other years.
And in trying to understand all this, what were you learning, aside from the fact that there were good black athletes who couldn't be part of college athletic programs?
Well, I think you learn tolerance. I mean, you learn to relate to black people as individuals rather than to relate to them just as a group or some stereotypical group. I think that was the main difference.
Do you remember how many black students were in your class?
You know, I can't remember, but I can remember the ones that I knew, and I'm wanting to say like about half a dozen or something like that that I actually knew.
In a class of roughly how many?
Oh, in a class of say maybe 100, 110, something like that.
Okay. And you said you remember the ones you knew. Now, did you know one or more fairly well? Or how would you say?
Well, just school friends at school, and the kids that you cheered for at the football and basketball games, the ones you were playing for, you, the ones you had classes with, the ones that you were in the same class with because you were the same age.
Did you ever find out what happened to any of these kids or where they went after high school?
At reunions, many of the kids left Richmond and went to other places.
Many of the, both black and white, or?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And in fact, I read that at the beginning of the 20th century, in the year 1900, that Lexington was about 40% black. Now I think it's 15%. Because of so much outward migration of black people and inward migration of white people. Because there simply wasn't a lot of opportunity here, and particularly not any opportunity for black people.
Well, And what, do you remember where they had gone and what they had done with their lives, any of these black classmates of yours?
The boys had gone into the service. I do remember that a high percentage of them had gone into the service. A smaller percentage had stayed in Richmond, had actually stayed there. And the girls, a lot of that depended on their husbands, because most of the girls got married and they you know, if their husband found a job in another city, that's where they moved to.
Did you, aside from athletics, were you aware of any other differences between your white classmates and your black classmates?
No, not really.
Okay. Differences in opportunities?
Because we all went to, oh sure, everyone was aware of the discrimination that existed. And in fact, in the late 50s and early 60s, there were sit-ins. And you couldn't help but go to the pool room. Boys would hang out at the pool room. You'd be sitting there at the counter eating a sandwich. And someone you went to school with who was black would have to come up to the window and get his sandwich to go. He wasn't allowed to eat inside.
This was in Richmond?
Yes.
While you were living there?
Right. And I mean, one of the most flagrant examples of discrimination that I saw, and in fact I wrote a column about it, might have been the one that your boss had seen. This was several weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago. I wrote a column about the first racial sit-in and civil rights demonstration I ever saw. We had seen these things on television in the Deep South, but we had never seen one where we were living. And so when it happened, everyone went to see it just out of curiosity. We'd never seen anything like that in person. And this was in Richmond. This would have been about 1959 or 60. And this was a picket line outside a drugstore next to the Glendon Hotel. And while we were standing there watching it, there were several black people carrying protest signs picketing the drugstore. And while we were watching, I'll never forget there were several of us college boys there. And the
several of the what?
Of us college boys.
Oh, okay.
Were there watching. And I'll never forget, the chief of police and the assistant chief of police came up. And they watched the demonstration for a moment or two. And then they turned to us, the boys who were standing there, and said very loudly, said, "Well, boys, we're going to go down the street and have lunch, and we'll be gone for an hour or two just in case anyone wants to break this up." And they made sure that we heard that, and then they walked off. And in fact, there was a college student who climbed up on the roof of the building that was being picketed and started throwing bricks down on the picketers from the top of the building. I witnessed that. I'll never forget it.
So you think that the police, I don't want to sort of ruin the poetry of this, if that's what you can call it, but you think really the police chief was asking somebody else to go after the black demonstrators, African American?
The only message I could receive from that, in effect, was we'll look the other way, you know, while you attack these people. This is the police chief and the assistant police chief. I think part of the mentality of the time was very provincial, because I later learned, when I became a reporter, And I was a police reporter back in the days when you got blood on your shoes, was that police, the police in a small town then had a fear of outside agitators. They were very provincial, they were very insular, and their thought was, hey, you have to be as tough and mean as possible to keep the bad guys out of your town. That was the philosophy they worked under.
So you think that the police attitudes went beyond race to the fear of the outsider?
Yeah.
That race was part of this.
Race was part of it, but they had a general philosophy, I think, that crime prevention consisted in having people who might tend to commit crimes to be afraid to do it in their hometown. The same thing was true in Lexington when I was a police reporter here. This was 10 years later. We're talking about mid and late 60s now. The police here had an attitude that, hey, you have to be so tough that the bad guys won't want to come to your town because they're afraid of the police. So they'll go commit crime someplace else, but not in your town.
Do you think if these so-called outside agitators, excuse me, if they were in fact outsiders, if they had been a group of white people who had some other cause, do you think the police would have been just as mean and tough?
My impression is that they would have been. The demonstrations that I saw, and then the things that I later covered when I was a reporter, had a very small outside core of organizers. Because local people usually had been intimidated, too intimidated to do this on their own, and so they would have to have someone from outside to help them get organized and have the courage to stand up and do this. And so that's where I think the police's view of outside agitators came from.
All right, so, but there also was an element of the local people having been intimidated. And were they intimidated by the police, by the business community, by whom?
I think they were intimidated every day of their lives. I mean, walk down to the courthouse square in Lexington and look at the guys in the courthouse yard, look at the two statues. They're both Confederates. I mean, can you imagine being a black child and growing up here and seeing that every day of your life? In Richmond, restaurants, theaters, things were still segregated.
So the message was part of the culture.
Oh yeah, the whole culture, I mean, throughout the culture was a discrimination. Hey, if you're black, you're a second-class citizen.
So it wasn't a matter that the local people had tried something and been intimidated and then called in outside agitators. They simply knew from living that they would need help, right?
Well, whether they had tried something and it had failed on their own or whatever the answer, civil rights were sweeping the country then, and everyone was getting interested in them. I think black people got interested in them in the large cities first, and then in the small towns. And it was just a movement whose time had came. You know.
Okay, well, let's now go back and pick up the thread of the chronological thread of your story. So you said that you you went to the Winchester Sun in 1964. That was your first job?
Right.
Okay. And what is that where you were a police reporter? What did you do for the Winchester Sun?
Well, I was more like beat reporter.
Beat reporter.
Yeah. I did everything.
Like what?
I covered all the news, wrote obituaries, helped lay out the paper, took photographs, developed the film, printed the pictures.
How many people worked at the Winchester Sun?
Maybe half a dozen. And it was a small town daily, and so you got to do a little bit of everything.
What, if anything, did you discover about the racial situation in Winchester?
Well, I began to see it for the first time as a member of the working press, and so it gave me a different perspective on that. I guess I began to see it in a more organized fashion, whereas before I'd simply seen it as a spectator with no, you know, particular view. At Winchester, I would cover things like NAACP meetings, or the...
Can we stop right there?
Sure.
What did you find at the NAACP meetings? What was going on? What was the agenda?
Oh, well, you know, you'd have a crowd of people and you'd sing the Black National Anthem, and there would be someone who would be a speaker, usually Reverend Porter Peoples from Lexington, or someone who was active in the movement. And one of the first things, I guess I should put it, one of the things that you were always asking the organizers, and there was a great burning curiosity then about how this was being funded and who was funding it, and whether or not it was funded by some communist front organizations, because this was still during the Cold War. And so civil rights organizers were always being asked, well, do you take money from the Communist Party, or would you accept donations from the Communist Party? I remember that. And but the meetings themselves, there was no violence or anything like that. They were just simply almost like governmental meetings or something.
Were they organizing protests or?
Yeah, well, they were to address problems in the community. For instance, when I began working at the newspaper was segregated. The only black people who worked for the newspaper worked in the back shop, back in the printing. None of them worked in the front. Everything was segregated in the newspaper, even the news, even the desks. That was true of the Lexington paper when I began working there, too. They ran a column for the black community. It would have a name like Colored Notes or something like that. I remember one of my first jobs when I began working at Lexington. And I should say this was long before Jack Knight bought the paper, long before it became a Knight Ritter paper. There would be a column, and this was not someone on the staff, because the staff in the newsroom was all white. But it was by a contract writer, someone who was paid to do that. I don't remember if she was paid on a space basis or just per column or what, but it was simply news notes from the black community.
Well, the contract writer wrote Colored Notes.
Yes. who had died, there would be obituaries, there would be lots of announcements of church meetings.
And that was all contracted out?
Yes. And some newspapers to this day still run a column like that, believe it or not. Take a look at the Richmond Register sometime. Over at Richmond, and they've changed the name of it, and the tone may be changed a little bit, but it's essentially still the same thing.
Okay, I interrupted you. You were talking about the Winchester Sun, and you talked about the NAACP meetings as how your perspective was developing as a journalist. And before I ask you for other examples, was there anything else about those NAACP meetings that has stayed with you?
Not really. One thing that did stay with me was something that happened at the newspaper while I was there. The newspaper had an advertising manager, and he didn't want to run paid advertising about these meetings. And I do remember he had an altercation with some black organizers who came in wanting this to be published in the paper. And they said, well, we'll come down and pick up your newspaper. And he said, well, how many will there be? And they said, well, we don't know. And he said, well, will there be more than six? Will there be seven or eight? And they said, well, we really don't know how many there will be. The point is, we will do this. And he said, well, I just wanted to know. And he whipped out a pistol and he said, because if there's, I've got six of them right here, so if there's more than six, then I'll worry about it. I still remember that. That would have been about 1965. I thought, good grief, how can you ever expect anything in the way of fairness if this is the newspaper behaving this way, the guy who was in charge of the advertising?
What did the blacks do?
They left.
Now.
And there was a man who worked in the back shop. He'd begun working there when he was a boy. Maybe 14 or something. This was a white man. And he was still working there 50 years later. He was an elderly man. I'll never forget one day, to the astonishment of me and one of the black guys, a man named Gassie Williams, who worked in the back, he brought out his Ku Klux Klan membership card and showed us the seal of the Ku Klux Klan and explained that he had been the secretary of the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan back in the 1920s. And I remember we didn't know what to say. We were just staring at it wide-eyed. Okay, you have to remember that we're talking about 1965. See, Winchester at that time was still a town that had a blackface minstrel show that was put on every year by the Lions Club, of all people.
I'm not exactly sure. Well, I have a question which I'll put off to one side.
Okay.
To ask you what else you covered then besides NAACP meetings that you remember that had anything to do with race relations.
Well, I'm trying to think. The Clark County Ministerial Association. because that was a group that included black and white ministers. And as I recall then, they had the black ministers had a couple of issues with the newspaper. I think maybe church notices they were still segregated. And see, we're talking about something so long ago it's hard to remember. You realize how much I've written and covered since then?
You're doing fine. Well, did you actually go to those meetings? Or
yes, the newspaper covered those meetings, and these issues would be brought up at the meetings and discussed. And I remember I was put on the spot once. They said, well, why does the newspaper do it this way? And I said, I honestly don't know. I don't determine policy at the newspaper, but my guess would be that the newspaper just reflects the community. It's the community that's segregated. And that's, you know, why some news is segregated in the newspaper.
How long were you at the Winchester Sun?
I was there for about, I guess, 18 months.
Did these attitudes, I mean, the man who whips out his pistol, the man with the Ku Klux Klan membership, the being put on the spot by the ministerial, says, did this have anything to do with your moving on?
You know, I honestly can't say that it directly did. I mean, there were a lot of other factors involved, too.
Well, then let me ask you what, unless there's more that we haven't covered, I mean, there's always more you haven't covered, but unless anything stands out that you want to talk about, maybe we could talk about what happened next and how it came about then.
Right. What I'm trying to say, I guess, is that the racism that I saw in Richmond and Winchester was almost casual. It wasn't the violent type of confrontational racism that you'd expect to see every day in Alabama or Mississippi or someplace like that. It was more polite, but it was still racism just the same.
So this whipping out of the pistol, maybe you don't call that violent. It seems violent to me, but that might have been the exception.
But that's an aberration.
Right. Okay.
And I think that's why I remember it, because that was so extraordinary. The same way that I remember the civil rights demonstration and the college boy throwing bricks from the top of the building, because that was just so extraordinary.
So it was almost more of an undercurrent than anything else. Okay. All right. So then what happened 18 months after you started working at the Winchester Sun?
Well, I worked for a newspaper in Indiana for a while. This was...
Where was it and what was it called?
This was in Bloomington. It was called Bloomington Tribune. It was a brand new newspaper, which is what attracted me to it, because there aren't many of those. And you don't usually get a chance to do that, to work for a new newspaper. And they were trying something different up there. And I went up there for, I guess, about a year. And my father was ill, and I came back to Kentucky, and I worked for the Herald Leader for a while. And then I was editor of the Clay City Times, which was a country weekly. I did that for a little while. And then I went back to the Herald Leader, and I was there for the rest of my career.
All right, maybe we could I mean, there may not be a whole lot you want to say, but I'm just curious to know. Well, you said they were trying something new at the Bloomington Tribune. This may not have anything to do with civil rights, but I'd just love to know what it was that they were trying that was different.
Well, it was a more modern production process. They were, I don't know if you're familiar with newspaper production or not, but that was the time when cold type was beginning to replace hot type. And photographic type of reproduction of type rather than setting it in melted lead. And so that was part of what was new and different about it. And it was just a fresh outlook, fresh start. They had recruited some people I thought I would like to work with, some people who were really talented and really smart that they had recruited from the Chicago area.
What about the race issue? Did you notice anything? Anything similar? Anything different?
I can't say that I noticed that much in Bloomington. The big issue at that time that was beginning to take over was the Vietnam War. And I covered lots of protests, but they were usually war protests. The kind where you'd go up and interview the guy sitting on the curb with a bloody nose, and he said, well, you've never been hit, do you? You've been hit by a pacifist.
So this would have been around 67?
Right.
There are some people that say that the protests against the Vietnam War never really happened until the white middle class was sent off to Vietnam, in addition to the minority groups which had gone to war in the earlier years in greater, proportionately greater numbers. What, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's correct. The first time I'd ever heard of Vietnam was at the Winchester Sun. And there was a boy from Clark County who was killed in the war. He was the first fatality from Clark County. And part of that story was to explain to the reader where Vietnam was. And even his own family couldn't tell me when I went out and interviewed them. And so I do remember in like 65, Vietnam was someplace you had to research and look up, and but a couple of years later the situation had entirely changed. There were huge demonstrations against the war, and as middle class kids did start getting killed and more body bags came back, I think that made a huge difference in the protests against the war.
So Vietnam has something to do with race. I mean, the Vietnam issue and the race issue have some kind of a meeting point.
I think there is a point of intersection there, but I think there's also a point of intersection of class there, too. As long as poor kids were being killed in Vietnam, I didn't see a lot of protests. It was when middle-class kids started being killed in Vietnam. That was when the protests began.
Okay, well, then after, if I'm not moving on too fast, after Bloomington, and your father became ill, and he came back to Kentucky and went to the Herald Leader, and you were there for what, a year or less?
Well, probably about a, yeah, that would be about right.
What greeted you there? Was there any kind of a culture shock, or did you just sort of move from one newsroom to the next?
Well, my feelings about the Herald Leader is that at that time the Herald Leader was behind most newspapers. The Herald Leader was run by a man named Fred Wachs, who was general manager, in effect the CEO of publishers.
How do you spell that name?
W-A-C-H-S. Fred B. Wachs. And he managed the property, which was actually owned by the heirs of a man named John G. Stahl, S-T-O-L-L. Stahl had died, and he had left the newspaper in trust to his heirs. The heirs, as nearly as I could tell, and I never saw one of them set foot in the building, were simply a bunch of wealthy alcoholics who lived in Palm Beach and clipped their coupons and only came to Lexington when the races were running at Keeneland in the spring and the fall.
So they left the running of the paper to Mr. Wachs.
Exactly. Mr. Wachs and the trust. And so there was discrimination in the newspaper, for instance, and it really bothered many of us who worked there, but we couldn't do anything about it. If a kid were arrested for marijuana possession, if you were a poor kid or black kid, his name went in the newspaper. If you were someone whose father knew someone that worked for First Security Trust, they could call the newspaper and have that name left out. So it was a family-run newspaper, but it was a long shot from, say, the Binghams in Louisville or someplace like that. And I don't mean to imply that the Binghams were all fair. I think the Binghams exercised the power that they had in Louisville not by the divine right of Binghams, but by the virtue of owning the only newspaper in town.
That?
Yeah.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about the fact that the Herald Leader had a colored notes and a contract writer who did separate material for obituaries and meetings for black people in groups. But how would you describe the Mr. Wachs' sort of overall attitude about how you run a newspaper from the point of view of race issues? Would you say there's an overriding philosophy?
Don't make waves.
Okay.
He didn't like for news of racial disturbances or civil rights marches to be put on the front page because he thought it would cause more of the same in Lexington. He thought it would eventually lead to violence in Lexington. And Mr. Wachs, how shall I put this? Part of him thought that the purpose of a newspaper was to reward your friends and punish your enemies, and he had a large number in both camps. Another part of him felt like that, in terms of civil rights, that he would help black people. For instance, he helped get the buses integrated in Lexington. But he felt that the best way to do it was quietly, to do it behind the scenes. He thought that was the best way to get things done because race was a very volatile issue. And it had exploded all over the country. He worried about it exploding in Lexington, too. And so I would say that he did have some sympathy for black people. At times it might be expressed paternally, but I think he did have some genuine sympathy for them.
talk about the Clay City Times, because then we're going to come back to the Herald Leader and we can talk some more about that. Why did you go to the Clay City Times? Oh, because they made you editor.
Well, no, because they made me editor. At that time, the editor had recently died, and I had a friend who went up there also to the Clay City Times to be the advertising director, and we'd actually thought about buying the newspaper, because at that time, the former editor's daughter didn't think she wanted to run the thing, and had talked about selling it, and we thought we'd give it a try and see how we liked running it, and see if it was something that we might want to buy.
I've lost a little track of the years, but you must have still been in your 20s at the time.
Yeah, I was still in my 20s, and but the deal fell through, and the guy who was doing the advertising, he didn't really like it that much, and he went back to where he came from, which I think was Frankfurt, and I went back to the Herald Leader.
All right, well, how long were you with the Clay City Times?
So I was up there, I was with the Clay City Times less than a year, I would guess.
And what did you find out about Clay City from the perspective of a journalist? Their attitudes, or what was going on?
I have to say that I don't think I can remember ever seeing a black person in Powell County. And I don't know whether that was my own fault, or maybe I wasn't as perceptive as I should have been or what, but it just seemed like racism was not an issue up there, that it was more like an all-white community. And of course, there weren't a lot of jobs up there. A lot of people who lived up there commuted to other surrounding counties for jobs. And
so I'm going to assume that we can now move on to your next and last stint with the Herald Leader.
Right.
And by now the year is?
We'd be talking.
Around 1970?
Yeah, no, we'd be talking late 60s, I guess. And I was a reporter at the Herald Leader, as most reporters did back then. I covered several different areas, like the tobacco market, the UK trustees. At one time or another, I covered all the beats, such as police or city hall, county government. I was also something that doesn't exist today. I was a rewrite man. That was back in the days when a lot of news, in order to get it in the paper as quickly as you could, it was telephoned in. And we would have, say, three or four reporters covering different aspects of the same story. And they would all call their reports into a central source, which was me, and I would put it together and write the story.
While you were covering these different areas, what did you like the best? What was the most interesting to you?
Well, probably the most interesting to me was writing. I had written a column at every newspaper I worked for, but in those days there weren't as many full-time columnists, and it was something you had to do on the side, so to speak. And the newspaper would to let you do it, they just thought it was an idiosyncratic thing for you to do.
Well, now when you say you like writing the best, I mean, that's what reporters do, they write. Do you mean you liked having a column?
No, I mean real writing, okay? I mean real writing.
Oh, I see a book here.
Yeah.
Okay. This book is Don Edwards' Life is Like a Horse Race, the best of Don Edwards.
So, I didn't become a full-time columnist. I was always a columnist, always had something going on the side. But I didn't become a full-time columnist until 1979.
So what you always wanted to do was be a columnist?
Right. I gave up being a city editor to be a columnist, to go back to writing, just because I loved writing so much more than editing.
Well, maybe we can talk in two phases here. Let's talk about the years as a reporter, just mostly insofar as what you covered.
Once again, we're focusing on civil
rights and racial issues. You said you were assigned to this and that, so what did you stumble across?
Well,
in the civil rights line.
In the civil rights line. Well, of course, the University of Kentucky was undergoing tremendous changes throughout that whole period. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not. But they had a terrific individual who was president named John Oswald, who wanted to drag the university kicking and screaming up and to academic respectability. And politically, he wasn't allowed to do that. That was back at a time when the governor was automatically the chairman of the Board of Trustees at UK. And went with being governor. And in fact, that's part of what sparked off the so-called student riots or civil disturbance in 1970 at the University of Kentucky, which was the largest civil disturbance that ever covered in Lexington. And that, I think, had something to do with the Cambodian invasion and the shooting of the students at Kent State. And students here at the university wanted the Board of Trustees to pass a resolution condemning the invasion of Cambodia and the shooting at Kent State, and the board would not do it, and that's when the trouble started, and it just kept escalating and escalating. Started out with a former governor named Happy Chandler, who was a member of the Board of Trustees. He punched a student in the nose. I covered that meeting, and I knew there was going to be further trouble, and so I was over there that night still covering things when the students burned a building. That's something that it took me 20 years to find out who burned the building, and I think I know who it was now, but I can't write about it because in Kentucky, a felony like arson, there's no statute of limitations on. Things that I noticed, I think Lexington was changing racially back then. The first black reporters, for instance, at the newspaper that I worked with would have come, that would have been sometime in the 70s.
Was this after Knight Ritter bought the paper?
Yes. At that time it was not Knight Ritter, it was Knight.
Sorry.
Jack Knight, as I should say, John S. Knight, but everyone at the racetrack called him Jack, owned a racing stable and boarded horses here. And that was how he got interested in the newspaper here, because he visited here quite often to check on his horses and watch them run at Keeneland. And so he's the one who bought the newspaper and changed everything. I guess that was about 1973. And black reporters began appearing. There's suddenly a lot more diversity in the newsroom and a different attitude, and lots of things had changed. Things had changed in Lexington at that time, too. Integration of the University of Kentucky basketball team. It was a huge symbolic step.
Well, you were there when that happened.
Yes.
Did you cover any of it?
I think the sports writers covered most of that.
But you obviously lived and worked there.
Right.
What do you remember about it?
Well, I remember that Adolph Rupp, the basketball coach, always thought had only one valid argument about not integrating his basketball team. And it was this, he kept saying, well, who will guarantee the safety of my players? He said, whenever we go down south to play in these ball games, as it is with a white team, we almost get killed. In Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama and places like that, they're terrible, they curse us, they throw bottles at us, they scream at us, they do all these things. And he said, if I take a black team down there, we'll guarantee their safety.
Well, you mean they curse and throw bottles anyway, even without an integrated team?
Exactly. And he said, who will guarantee their safety? It'll be even more inflammatory, there will be more violence. And of course, you have to remember the emotional context of the times. There was a lot of violence going on in the South back then. And people were being killed. I mean, you know, blown up, it was a dangerous place. And he didn't want, I think he had a reluctance to be the first, because he didn't see that there was a problem in Kentucky that was as severe, say, as in Alabama or someplace like that. And he thought, you know, why should I be first? Why should we have to take the punishment? And I thought he had a legitimate question when he did say, who'll guarantee the safety of my players? Because no one seemed to want to to do that. And so in that case, it's where the wrong path is at the same time the easiest path. It was easier not to integrate the basketball team.
You're right. You write about this kind of thing in this article you wrote in Sunday's, was it Sunday's paper? February 17th.
Yeah, it's easier to not do anything, to not get involved, than to get involved and put yourself in danger of some sort.
Did you ever bump up against the young man who wrote for the Colonel, the student newspaper?
Oh, sure. And the Courier Journal reporters, too. We used to bump up against all of them.
Because as I recall, the Colonel was pushing for the integration of the basketball team. And I just didn't know whether the student paper and the Herald Leader ever communicated at all.
No, I'm sure they didn't. And because when you were covering protests on campus, the students would ask you where you were from, and if you said you were from the Courier Journal, they applauded and cheered, and if you said you were from the Herald Leader, they booed you.
Not after Jack Knight took it over. In the earlier.
Because they felt like the newspaper hadn't done enough as an institution, or at least enough publicly. I think more was done than the students understood. But I think the publisher hadn't done more, but he had done it behind the scenes and quietly in a political power play kind of way. The old building was behind the courthouse downtown at that time, and it was a respectable...
The old Herald Leader building?
Yeah, the old newspaper building, and it was a respectable building. Mr. Walks, in a way, had a bunker mentality about some things, and he became very frightened during the 60s. You got to remember, college kids were bombing the Bank of America. And it looked like a revolution. And at that time, he put this protective shell around the building on the outside, made of fiberglass, which was fire repellent in case someone tried to throw Molotov cocktails at the newspaper. All that seems laughable now, but in the context of the times, it was pretty reasonable, actually.
I can remember
when Nixon resigned. Everyone sat by the teletypes at the newspapers in newsrooms all over the country and wondered whether or not he was going to resign or he was going to call out the military and seize power. We didn't know which it would be. Mm-hmm.
Some people understood it was a constitutional crisis. Now, when did Walks sell the paper? What year was that? Do you remember?
Mr. Walks never did sell the paper.
Oh.
The First Security Trust sold the newspaper. And I believe it was 73. Prior to that, Mr. Walks became senile and retired, and he literally had to be let out of the building. He became ill and could no longer run the building. At that time, a really young guy who had been groomed for the job, been groomed for several years, his name was Tom Buckner, took over as general manager. And Tom Buckner was running the Herald Leader at the time it was sold to John Knight in, I guess it was 73, about then.
But effectively, Walk's leadership would have ended a year or two before then?
Right.
Well, I was just thinking, maybe you can comment on this, that about the time that the leadership of the Herald Leader changed was about the time, was it not, when the world or the country was also beginning to look a little safer. So, I mean, in 1973, the Vietnam War was winding down. Perhaps even Mr. Walks, if he had been functional, would have realized that he maybe didn't need that protective shell anymore. So, I mean, and so the leadership of the paper is changing, and also the attitudes of the paper, they're hiring black reporters and everything, just as things are calming down.
Right.
Isn't that right?
So yes.
There's a coincidence there, I guess.
That's a fair statement. And really the main thing on the table when Mr. Knight bought the paper was building a new building and buying a new press and doing things like that, because what he bought essentially was a subscription list. I mean, the equipment was worn out, the building was old and terrible condition and too small, much too small. It stood on the little parking lot that's behind the courthouse today, and you can go down and look at that tiny parking lot and wonder, how in the world did we ever put a newspaper out there? But we had the entire operation there, the loading docks, the press, everything. So actually when he bought the paper, their first concern was, hey, we've got to bring this thing up to date. But because the heirs had taken a lot of money out of it, we won't have a spot in the newspaper anymore. And I was really astonished by that. But yet I can see how those institutions, you know, how those things become institutionalized, and how there's a certain security and a certain feeling about those things. And it's, you know, human beings are short view creatures. It's hard to see the long view.
What do you know, or do you want to speculate on the motivations of the horse farm owners wanting black schools? Was this a humanitarian viewpoint, or was it...
Well, you have to remember the people who owned the horse farms. I mean, you know, these were wealthy people. Many of them were from the East. And, heck, I think probably two out of three people in Kentucky who fought in the Civil War fought for the Union side. So in a way, this is a southern state, but in another way, it was a more liberal, more divided state, too. And
so it was genuine.
Yeah. And I think about Hamburg Place, for instance, Preston and Anita Madden's farm. I've looked through that farm album, and you can go back and 1905 or something, they're making sure that the people who work on the farm, those that are black people, They're making sure those children are sent to school, if they get an education. And so, you know, wealthy, enlightened individuals, so to speak, own the horse farms. And I think that made a difference. I think the Jewish community in Lexington has made a difference. The Jewish community has been very progressive and had a great sense of fair play, and many members of the Jewish community came from other places when they came to Lexington.
You mean they've made a difference generally?
In the cultural level, in the educational level, and in anything progressive, it was my experience, you would always find leaders in the Jewish community behind it. They would always be involved. And I felt like also the Catholic community here lived out their religion, that they got involved in social justice and in social causes. I can't say that as much for the so-called fundamentalist Christians, for the Bible Belt. I grew up in the Bible Belt, and I never could understand how people could be preaching the wrath of God on the radio, and those same people would go out and there'd be a car wreck, and they would run over and see the person who had had the wreck was a Catholic priest, and just turn around and walk off and leave him to die. That's the sort of town I grew up in.
No good Samaritans, huh?
Right. Not if you were a Catholic. You would have been another fundamentalist Christian, and that would have been okay. But it was the Bible and the gun. And I think religious fundamentalism is just generally repressive, whatever form it takes, whether it's what we're dealing with right now with the Muslims, a sect of them that did 9/11, or whatever it is. I think it's generally repressive. It's really wonderful what can be done by people who are enlightened.
Do you remember, Betsy Brinson, who's in charge of this project, mentioned a few names to me of people who apparently were involved in civil rights in one way or another in Lexington. And I just wonder if you remember any of them by virtue of being a journalist. One was a white woman named Abby Marlette.
Right, I remember Abby Marlette.
Did you have anything to do with, did you bump up against her at all?
I would run across her at different things. For instance, if I was covering a city hall meeting, city commission back then, before we had the urban county, before we had the council, I would run across her, just maybe bumping. You knew who she was. She was an activist, and she was always working for some good cause.
Do you remember Bob Estill, who was at Christ Episcopal Church?
I remember that name, but I never did really know Bob Estill that well.
A man named Joe Graves, a white businessman and legislator.
Oh, I know Joe Graves. Yes, I know Joe Graves very well. One reason I know him is because he sued the newspaper.
Why?
During one of his mayoral campaigns, the newspaper ran a story that had been planted, I think, by the opposing candidate. Anyway, what the story said in effect was that he had underassessed his net worth for the purposes of the campaign. And he said that wasn't right, and he sued him. And he won the court, but he lost on appeal.
Do you remember anything about him in connection with any of the civil rights goings-on, particularly?
Joe Gray's daughter, I believe now, is the one who's leading this PDR fight that we've got going on in Lexington.
Well, What is
that? I don't
that?
Know if you're familiar with that or not. It's property development rights, whereby you sell to the city your property development rights, and you save the farmland, save the bluegrass, save the horse country, that sort of thing. That's his daughter who's doing that. I knew Joe Gray's, and I knew Joe Gray's mother, and they were both very interested in any sort of progressive action or movement around here.
There was Audrey Grievous, who was the president of the NAACP and also involved in CORE. Did you ever come up against her?
You know, that name does sound familiar, but I don't think I would have come across her in any of the beats that I was covering at that time.
And the last one is a African-American nurse named Julia Lewis, who was also involved with the NAACP and CORE, but not so.
I vaguely remember that name, but that's about as much as I can remember. You know, most of the stuff that I covered, as I said, there was a great movement in journalism. Civil rights was one of the great things that journalism worked on. It was one of the big stories.
Okay, I'll put that on the door. There's a knock on the door. All right.
One of the great stories of that time had been the civil rights movement from its inception all the way to changing the law and integration of schools and housing and things like that. And I sort of got in on the tail end of that as a journalist. That was somehow not being as big a story, particularly after 68 with the assassination of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. And at that time, the movement seemed to change from what Martin Luther King had wanted, which was a rational, sane, progressive movement, to a kind of black nationalism. And it became more extreme and or whatever. But the big story that was emerging, of course, in the 60s, the big news story, was the Vietnam War. And that's what we seem to devote more of our time and resources to, as the protests grew bigger, and it seemed to just affect every nook and cranny in the country.
When you moved from being a reporter to being a columnist, did you move into any of the decision, did you move into a decision-making position as well?
No, the only decision I made was what I was going to write about in my column. Now,
did you ever write about civil rights as a columnist?
You know.
Or was it, once again, was this a focus on Vietnam?
No, as a columnist, well, I was going to tell you, when I was on an editorial board, the Lexington Leader at the time I was city editor of the Lexington Leader. And that was when the town still had two newspapers. And the morning newspaper was the state newspaper and had a Democratic editorial page. And the afternoon paper was the hometown paper and had a Republican editorial page. So, and I wrote editorials and did some of that then. When I became a columnist, though, my column's tone was usually light. And I didn't get that much involved in issues. It was more about personalities. It might be political satire. It was usually more about other things. Just by the nature of the column.
When we were off tape, and then I forgot to get back to this, you did sort of run through what your duties at the, what, leader and then herald leader were? In other words, you said you were a this and then a that. City editor was one of them.
I'm the only one who's ever been crazy enough to be city editor of both newspapers. I was a reporter, and I had a knack for writing, though. And those were still the days of the rewrite person. And if you had any ability at all toward writing, that was what they wanted you to be, because that was what they really needed. They could hire reporters at a dime a dozen, but they really wanted rewrite people, because it was just so much more difficult physically to put out the newspaper. Then I started in this business with melted lead manual typewriters. Now it's all electronic. It's, you know, completely changed. The technology has been the biggest change in my lifetime in the business.
So rewriting's a snap?
Yeah.
Relatively.
Generally, I'm trying to think about civil rights coverage in general. One thing that I did not mention is the swimming pool situation.
Where?
Now, in Richmond, Kentucky, which had no public swimming pool, the J.C.'s finally built one, but that pool closed. And I think that pool closed because the government ordered the community to integrate it. Sadly, I have been told by people who would know that the same thing happened at Old Joyland Park here in Lexington. Joyland Park was an amusement park on Parrish Pike, and a very popular one. And Joyland Park closed, I'm told, because the owner didn't want to integrate swimming pool. And so there was a big to-do about that sort of thing in the 50s. Just like I mentioned in the column I wrote that ran last Sunday about one of the state parks proudly advertised itself as the only state park in the nation just for colored people. That seems hard to believe now. It just seems, you know, incredible. That park was in Western Kentucky. It had some sort of Indian name like Camp Cherokee or something like that. And I understand that the land was eventually absorbed when the days of integration came. The land was absorbed and became part of another state park down there. I don't know how that was swept under the rug and hushed up, but so many of those things have been forgotten. Just how racial discrimination was almost omnipresent. It was in everything. Everywhere you looked, it was in the culture.
Perhaps then we can sum up by my asking you, and I'm assuming it's very much the kind of thing you've talked about for the last little while, but maybe you could encapsulate it for us. You said in this same column last February 17th, this past February 17th, I suppose it's because I think that black history is Kentucky history.
Right.
Now, can you put that into a few sentences, why you said that?
Well, it's because I said the history is the truth of human experience. And it's everybody's experience, not just one group. And to me, different perspectives on history are like streams that all flow into the same river. And you don't really understand the river unless you understand all of those streams. And that's why it's important, I think, that people, that white people particularly, read some black history. Because I think many white people think Black History Month or Martin Luther King Day or whatever is something in which they have no stake. They think, well, that's something for black people, but it doesn't affect me. And so it's a kind of a psychological segregation. That's why I simply think that that kind of history is important. I'm a great history reader. I don't know if you've ever read this book or not, but surely you know who Tom Clark is.
Oh, yes.
And I've taken lots of unpopular stands at the newspaper. I was the first person, I think, at the Herald Leader to write about gay people as people. And I'm really proud of the way he inscribed that book.
This book is called The Kentucky by Thomas B. Clark, and it's inscribed to Don Edwards with highest regards and profound respect, Tom Clark, November 17, 2000.
And I'm really proud of that because I have taken on unpopular things. One of the latest is the debate over slot machines. And it's difficult to go against the flow, even if you know the flow is wrong. It's easier to go along and get along. And my wife used to fear for me all the time because I would get death threats. But you try to stand up for what's right in journalism, and you try not to be dogmatic. What you're really trying to do is find out the truth. And if you have some preconceived idea of it, it's almost always wrong. You have to get out there and get in it to find out what it really is. I think newspapers can err going both ways. They can be too dogmatically liberal and too dogmatically conservative. And neither approach is completely right. You have to get out there and try your best as much as you humanly can to be objective and see both sides and just find out what the real truth is. And that's what I've tried to do in journalism. In an entertaining way, with a column. And of course, a columnist is allowed to express an opinion. Reporters aren't supposed to, but sometimes they do anyway. And today they call that spin, but it's always been around and called other things.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
I have enjoyed it.
May I get you something to drink? Would you like a Coke or a glass of water or something?
Maybe a glass of water.
Sure.
I'll turn this off now.